Okay, so today we're diving into a case that really brings up some fascinating questions about parental rights, the role of local governments, and then this whole kind of tricky area of emancipation. And we're looking at all of this through through one specific case, Anne Reed Calgary v. St. Louis County.
Yeah, this one's a real head scratcher.
It is. And, especially if you're a law student out there and you're wrestling with, big concepts like 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 qualified immunity, state action doctrine, like this is definitely the case for you.
Absolutely. This Eighth Circuit decision really throws you right into the deep end of how these like bedrock constitutional law concepts actually play out in, real life situations.
Yeah, for sure.
And at the heart of it, we have Anne Marie Calgaro. She's a mother, and she comes up against this pretty significant obstacle. She can't get access to her transgender child's medical and educational records.
Right, and the child's initials are EJK.
EJK, right? And the real twist here is that EJK is claiming emancipation, but it's all based on a letter from a legal aid group.
Oh, so not a court order.
Not a court order, exactly. And that's a really important detail. So what we're gonna try to untangle here is, did the other folks involved, did they go too far? Did they actually violate Calgaro's rights as a parent under the 14th Amendment? That whole due process thing.
Okay, so much to unpack here.
Yeah.
But before we even get into like the legal arguments and why the court ruled the way it did, we need to understand what actually happened, right? Like the
Right.
timeline of events. So what led up to this lawsuit in the first place?
Okay, so let's start with EJK leaving home at 15.
Okay.
And then they get this letter from Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. And this letter says that EJK is legally emancipated under Minnesota law.
Okay, but we were just saying, you need a court order for that.
Exactly. And here's the thing. In Minnesota, if you want to legally emancipate a minor, it's not enough to just have a letter. You absolutely need that formal court order.
Okay.
So this letter on its own, it doesn't actually hold any legal weight.
Got it.
But even so, EJK uses this letter to get gender-affirming care at a couple different medical providers, Fairview Health and Park Nicollet. And to make things even more complicated, St. Louis County was actually funding some of these medical services.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it doesn't stop there. The St. Louis County School District also took this letter at face value. They said, okay, you're emancipated. And they allowed EJK to make their own decisions about their education.
So basically, they cut the mother out of the loop.
Essentially, yeah.
Wow. So we have this letter that doesn't really meet the legal requirements for emancipation being used to justify some pretty major life decisions.
Right.
And then on top of that, it's being used to prevent a parent from getting information about their child.
Yeah. You can see how this is going to lead to some conflict.
Absolutely. So
Yeah.
this is where Calgro is like, all right, I'm going to try and get these records, medical and school records, and she's denied.
Right. And the reasons they give for denying her are
Yeah.
interesting. So the medical providers, they point to Minnesota Statute Section 144.346, which basically says that minors can control their own medical records if they're the ones who consented to the treatment.
Makes sense.
The school district and the principal, they have a different justification. They say, well, EJK is emancipated, so you don't have a right to those records.
And again, they're basing that on this letter.
Yep, the very same letter.
So you have a mother being denied access to her child's records, all because of a document that doesn't seem to hold up legally. I can see why she'd feel like her rights were violated.
Definitely. And that's what leads her to take legal action.
Okay, so walk me through that. What happens next?
Calgaro files a lawsuit under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983.
Okay, and for our listeners who might not be familiar with that one, what does that cover?
Right. So this is the statute that lets individuals sue state and local governments and, their officials when they believe their constitutional rights have been violated.
So it's a pretty big deal.
Oh, yeah. It's a major tool for holding the government accountable.
Okay, so she's suing under Section 1983, and what's her argument?
Her argument is that her 14th Amendment rights as a parent have been violated by all of this.
Okay, but what happens at the district court level?
The district court dismisses all her claims,
Oh, wow.
but she doesn't give up. She appeals that decision to the Eighth Circuit.
What's the result there?
The Eighth Circuit upholds the district court's decision.
Okay, so they agree with the dismissal.
Yep. And, the real core of what the Eighth Circuit had to grapple with was whether the county, the school district, the principal, were they acting based on some kind of unconstitutional policy or custom that led to this whole denial of her parental rights?
Okay, so the focus shifts. Now, it's not just about individual actions, but whether there's a bigger systemic problem.
Exactly.
So let's break down the court's analysis of these legal issues, starting with this idea of Monell liability.
Okay.
So how did the court approach this question of whether St. Louis County as an entity could be held responsible?
This is where it gets really interesting, because the court draws a line in the sand between what individual employees do and the actual policies or customs of the government entity itself.
Okay.
And they're basing this on Monell v. Department of Social Services, which is like the landmark case for this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Monell says that a local government can only be on the hook under Section 1983 if the constitutional violation happened because of a policy or a custom that the government like officially endorsed or kept doing.
Okay, so it can't just be a rogue employee doing their own thing.
Right. It has to be something more systemic, something that suggests the government itself is behind it.
Got it. So how does Calgro try to argue that this applies to St. Louis County?
Well, she claims that the county basically had this unofficial policy of treating any minor who showed up with a letter like the one from Legal Aid as emancipated.
So like they were just accepting these letters as official without a court order.
Right. And she's saying this is a custom they have that's depriving parents of their rights.
Okay. But the Eighth Circuit doesn't agree.
No, they don't.
So why not? I mean, it seems like the county, at least in this instance, did act based on that letter. They funded those medical services. Wouldn't that point towards some kind of policy?
Well, the court focuses on the fact that Calgro only gave them evidence of this one single case. You know how St. Louis County handled EJK's situation based on that specific letter?
Mm-hmm.
And the Eighth Circuit was very clear that under Monell, just showing isolated incidents or even mistakes made by one employee, it's usually not enough to prove that a government has this widespread practice or official policy.
So one mistake doesn't equal an unconstitutional policy.
Exactly. And they actually say this in their opinion. It's a pretty important takeaway. They say, one erroneous determination by a county employee that EJK was emancipated does not establish a policy or custom of the county that deprives parents of their constitutional rights.
So they're saying, look, it might have been wrong what this employee did, but you haven't shown us that this is a regular thing for the county.
Right. And this tells us that to prove municipal liability under Section 1983, it's a pretty high bar.
Yeah, you need a strong case.
You need to show a pattern, a consistent way of operating, not just a single screw up.
And I imagine that's got to be tough for someone trying to prove that a local government violated their constitutional rights.
It definitely can be.
So even if that county employee messed up by relying on that letter, it doesn't automatically mean the county has this whole unconstitutional policy in place.
Right.
Okay, so let's move on to the school principal now and this concept of qualified immunity.
Okay.
For our listeners who might be new to this, what exactly is qualified immunity and how did it play into the court's decision about Calgro getting access to her child's school records?
So qualified immunity, this is basically a legal shield for government officials. It protects them from personal liability when they get sued, unless it's super clear that they violated someone's statutory or constitutional rights.
So like they have to know they were breaking the law.
Yeah. And not just know, but it has to be really well established law. Like there's no question about it.
Okay. So in this case, Calgro's saying that the principal messed up by denying her access to those records,
mm-hmm.
right?
Exactly. She's claiming that he violated her parental rights.
But the Eighth Circuit sides with the principal and they give him qualified immunity.
Yep. They say he's protected.
So what was their reasoning? Did they say that a parent's right to their child's school records isn't a clear cut, right?
That's exactly it. They looked at the existing case law and they said, you know what, the scope of a parent's constitutional right to those records, it's not clearly defined. It's kind of a gray area.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, and they actually say this in their opinion. They say it remains open to question whether parental rights mandate access.
So because the law was fuzzy at the time, the principal couldn't have known for sure that he was doing something wrong.
Precisely, and that's where qualified immunity comes in. When the law is uncertain, it acts as a shield protecting officials from getting sued, even if they make mistakes.
It's like saying, hey, we need to give these officials some breathing room to do their jobs, without being afraid of getting sued all the time.
Right, because if they're constantly worried about getting sued, they might not be able to make tough decisions or, you know, do what they think is right.
But then some people argue that it ends up protecting officials even when they make bad calls, especially when the law is still developing.
Yeah, that's the other side of the coin for sure. It's a delicate balance.
It is. Okay, so the principal gets qualified immunity even if in the future a court says, you know what, parents absolutely have a right to those records.
Right, because he made that decision when the law wasn't clear.
Got it. Okay, so now let's turn to the medical providers, Fairview Health and Park Nicollet.
There.
Now, Calgaro is arguing that because they took money from the county and they accepted that emancipation letter, they basically became like arms of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so they should be treated as state actors. What did the court say about that?
So this brings us to the state action doctrine, which is basically the test for when a private person or a company can be seen as acting on behalf of the government.
And if they're considered state actors, then they're subject to the Constitution, right?
Exactly. And that means they can be sued under Section 1983.
Okay.
Now, the Eighth Circuit, they take a two-part approach to analyze this, and ultimately they shoot down Calgaro's argument.
So walk me through that two-part test.
Okay. So first, they reaffirm this long-standing principle that private companies, they don't just magically become state actors by working with the government or getting money from them.
So, like, just because a company gets a government contract, it doesn't mean they're suddenly the government.
Right. There has to be more to it.
Yeah.
To hold a private actor liable under Section 83, you need to show that there's this close connection or even pressure from the state going beyond just giving them money.
So more like the state is pulling the strings.
Yeah, like a puppet master situation.
Got it. And what about the second part of the test?
So the second part really zeroes in on Minnesota Statute Section 144.341.
Okay.
And this law is all about minor consent to medical care.
Mm-hmm.
It says that certain minors can agree to their own medical treatment without needing their parents' permission.
So even without being emancipated.
Right. And importantly, it doesn't end the parents' rights completely. It's more nuanced than that.
Interesting.
So the court's logic is that even if the medical providers made a mistake by thinking EJK was fully emancipated based on that letter, they were still operating within the state law that gives minors some power to consent to their own care.
So they were following a law that was already on the books.
Exactly.
What about that other statute, the one about medical records?
Right. So Minnesota Statute, Section 144.346, this one comes into play, too. Because EJK consented to her own treatment under that law, she gets to decide who can see her medical records.
And that's why Calgaro was blocked.
Exactly.
So even though this whole thing started with a letter that wasn't really valid, the medical providers were still following the steps laid out in state law.
Right. And the court really hammers home this point. They say that just because a private company is following a state law, even if it means a parent can't access something, it doesn't automatically make them a state actor under Section 1983.
So they were following the rules for doctor-patient confidentiality,
yeah.
Not enforcing some kind of state policy about parental rights.
Right. They're two separate things.
It's a really important distinction.
It is. Okay. So we've covered Monell liability. We've talked about qualified immunity and the state action doctrine.
Yeah.
There's one last piece of the legal puzzle here, and that's mootness.
Okay. So for those of us who aren't legal experts, can you break down what mootness is and how it played a role in this case?
Sure. So mootness is a legal concept that basically says if the issue at the heart of a case has already been resolved or doesn't exist anymore, then the case is moot. It's not a live controversy anymore.
So, like, there's nothing for the court to decide.
Exactly. Now, in Calgaro's case, there's a bit of a timing issue.
Uh-oh.
By the time her appeal got to the Eighth Circuit, EJK had turned 18.
Oh, so they were no longer a minor.
Right. And that changes things significantly because remember, she was asking for injunctive relief. She wanted the court to order that she could access those records and participate in EJK's medical and educational decisions. But now that EJK is an adult, Calgaro doesn't have the same legal rights as a parent to make those calls or see those records.
So even if she had won on her other arguments,
yeah.
It wouldn't have gotten her what she wanted.
Exactly. The court couldn't give her the specific relief she was asking for because the situation had changed.
So it was like the issue had kind of resolved itself, even though not in the way she wanted.
Right. And the court actually says this. They say, there is no ongoing case or controversy over Calgaro's parental rights to make decisions for EJK as a minor or to access her medical or educational records.
So even if her rights were violated while EJK was still a minor, it's too late for the court to do anything about it.
That's essentially it, and it really highlights how important it is to take legal action quickly while the issue is still live.
Yeah, timing is everything.
It can be. So to sum up, even if Calgaro had a strong case for a constitutional violation, the fact that EJK became an adult during the appeals process really limited what the court could do.
Okay, so that was a lot to cover. But let's try and distill some key takeaways for our listeners, especially those law students out there who are trying to wrap their heads around all this. What are the main lessons we can learn from Calgaro v. St. Louis County?
There are a few really important ones. First, this case really shows us how tough it is to prove Monell liability. You can't just point to one isolated event and say, that means a local government has an unconstitutional policy or practice.
Right. You need more than just one incident.
Exactly. You have to provide solid evidence that there's a pattern, a regular way of doing things, or an official directive from the government that caused that violation to happen.
Okay. What else?
Second, this case is a great example of how qualified immunity works in practice. It shields public officials when the law in a specific area is kind of unclear.
So if there's no clear precedent to say what's right and wrong, they're protected.
Exactly. And that allows them to do their jobs without constantly worrying about getting sued.
But like we said, it also means they might get away with things even if they made a bad decision.
That's true.
Okay, and what about those state laws we talked about?
Right, so this case also highlights how important state statutes are. They can really shape how constitutional claims play out.
And in this case, those Minnesota laws about minor consent to medical care were central to the whole discussion.
Definitely, they influenced how the court looked at the state action doctrine and ultimately shaped the outcome.
So sometimes you have to look beyond just the federal constitution to really understand what's going on.
Absolutely. You have to consider the whole legal landscape.
Okay. Anything else?
Yeah. The case also shows the limitations of the state action doctrine. Just because a private entity gets funding from the government or works with them in some way, it doesn't automatically turn them into a state actor who can be sued under Section 1983.
It's not that simple.
Nope. You need to show a stronger connection, like the government is directing or controlling their actions.
Like a puppet master again.
Exactly.
And finally, that whole mootness issue. It's a good reminder that timing is crucial in legal cases.
Right. If circumstances change, like a minor turning 18, it can drastically change what legal remedies are even possible.
Even if you have a good argument, it might be too late for the court to do anything.
Exactly. So this case is a great example of how all these different areas of law, constitutional law, state law, procedural rules, they all come together in a real life situation.
It's like they all intersect.
They do, and it makes things complicated.
It does, for sure. But it also makes it fascinating, right?
Absolutely.
This case, it really brings up a lot of questions about how we balance the rights of parents with the growing autonomy that minors are being given, especially when it comes to things like healthcare and education.
It does, and it makes you think about what happens when those rights clash,
yeah.
You know, and how schools and medical providers navigate these situations.
Yeah, that's a lot to consider.
It is, and I think it's something we'll be grappling with for a while.
Definitely. All right, well, that's about all the time we have for this deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
But this case, it really gives us a lot to think about.
It does. It's a good one.
It is. Thanks for breaking it down for us.
You're welcome.
And for all our listeners out there, keep those legal brains churning.
And always read the fine print.
That's good advice. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Until next time.
See you then.